Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Judgment Call, a podcast where I talk to risk takers, adventurers, travelers, entrepreneurs, and simply mind bogglers. My name is Torsten Jacoby and I'm your host. Today, my guest is David Yaskel. David has covered the cruise industry and Las Vegas travel options for several trade publications like Travel Weekly, The Travel Agent, and Travel Age West. He's also appeared on radio and TV as an expert of Vegas hospitality and entertainment in Vegas, and he himself is quite the cruise connoisseur. David knows where to find the best travel deals, not just in Vegas, but today we're going to talk about cruises, how not to get bored on a cruise, what to do, what not to do, and find the best deals. I hope you'll enjoy. Judgment Call is sponsored by Mighty Travels Premium. Mighty Travels Premium finds the best airfare and hotel deals from anywhere to anywhere. Mighty Travels Premium scans 450,000 fares every day just to find the exact deal you really want. You can customize and select from hundreds of easy notification options. The company's AI works tirelessly and in real time to send you the airfare and hotel deals anywhere you specify. On average, Mighty Travels Premium subscribers save $190 with just one ticket buy. Some users have saved up to 95% with mistake fares to Asia in business class for under $600 round trip, or when they buy 5-star hotels in Dubai, New York, or Chile for under $50 per night. Mighty Travels Premium is less than $5 per month when purchased annually, or $7.99 per month when purchased through a monthly plan. Try out Mighty Travels Premium today and sign up with the code JUDGMENTCALL for your 30-day risk-free trial. That is www.mightytravels.com/judgmentcall for your 30-day risk-free trial.
So, David, my first question was, you know, you are an expert in cruises and Vegas. For me, that's kind of two very opposite ways of traveling. They're both a bit of mass travel. How did you get into this? How did that all start?
Yeah, so they are very different, but I think both are represent very innovative products. So years ago, I was a part-time travel agent, and I loved cruising. I discovered cruising was really great, and I also loved going to Vegas. I was close by, living in Los Angeles, and I started writing for a travel trade magazine about both, and both had their own advantages. You know, cruising, I think, is a great vacation value, also a very innovative industry. The ships are continually progressing, new, bigger ships with all kinds of wild options on board. And Las Vegas, I think, is the most creative and innovative tourist destination on Earth. It changes so rapidly and with fascinating results. So both of those became a kind of an interest point for me, and I decided to specialize in both as I continued writing.
Okay. How long have you been doing this? Like 20 years or?
I've been doing this about 25 years on both cruise and Las Vegas, primarily writing for travel trade magazines. So this would be Travel Weekly, Travel Age West, magazines that are aimed at travel agents and people in the industry. So I've got to know my stuff because I'm writing for a very discerning group of readers who think they know more than I do. And I've got to prove that I know more than they do, right?
So I always have this as kind of one of the mandatory questions to get started. How many countries have you been to? How many trips did you take to other countries?
How many trips I've been to other countries? I didn't keep count. I would estimate that maybe 20 countries.
Okay, that's a good collection.
Yeah, it's a decent sized collection.
What was your favorite? Where do you think back to and say, wow, that was totally unexpected and that was really exciting?
I think I had two favorites, and I can narrow them down to cities within the country. So my first is probably Florence, Italy. I've been there a couple of times. I was so impressed by it. You know, the art. They say that the art runs in the sewers in Florence. And it really does. The artwork on the street, the Michelangelo's history there, the Uffizi, the Accademia, the Church of Santa Croce, all this gorgeous Renaissance art. And the city has a fascinating history, of course. So for that reason, Florence is one of my favorites. And the other is St. Petersburg, Russia. I think it's a fascinating city, specifically what they went through during World War II, during the siege, It's fascinating that the city survived that, and it really made turn them into what they are today, I think. And just also fascinating from an artistic standpoint, from a historic and cultural standpoint, and with the World War II history, you know, blended in, it also made a big impression on me. So I think those two cities, Florence and St. Petersburg, made the biggest impression on me of all the other places I've traveled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are awesome cities, and there is so much unexpected art to see, especially in Florence. I totally agree with you. I do think you went there on a cruise, right? They're both big cruise destinations, and I feel for St. Petersburg, there wasn't a visa requirement for cruise arrivals until recently, at least. Is that correct?
Yes, there is. That's correct. There is a visa requirement now. But there's a tip I could give you and our listeners, and that is if you're on a cruise visiting St. Petersburg and you're just going to buy the shore excursions from the ship, you don't need to apply for a Russian visa. You can just you're covered by a visa from the tour operator. Even if you buy a third-party tour, that tour operator will cover you with the visa when they pick you up in the terminal. So people are under this mistaken impression that they always need a tourist visa for Russia, Americans, and they don't, as long as they're using a tour company either through the ship or, you know, on their own as a third party. They just can't go explore on their own off the ship without a visa.
Yeah. That's a good way to save. I personally applied a couple of times for a Russian visa, and that process used to be extremely easy. It had this demonic bureaucracy to it when you first read through the guidelines. But the application, at least here in San Francisco at the consulate, and then they had an outsourced visa office, it was actually very easy, very straightforward. And as many other major countries, you can get 10-year visa for just $120, $140. Unfortunately, these visa fees have increased quite a bit. And it was a 7-year visa, not a 10-year visa. But it's still a lot of time. It's multiple entries with the U.S. passport. Now I think the visa fees have gone up to somewhere around $300. And if you use an agency, that's another $100 to $150. So typically it's $500, not just for the visa, which is outrageous.
It is outrageous.
A lot of people skip Russia because it's just not worth it to them. $100, you know, that seems expensive, but, you know, kind of the standard for many countries, but $500 is just too much. So a lot of people skip St. Petersburg, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. And they shouldn't. They shouldn't, because it's so fascinating. And really, the Baltic cruise itineraries, pretty much every ship sailing the Baltic calls it St. Petersburg for at least 2 days. For, 3 days and two nights. And it's really the most popular port in the Baltic region for all those reasons.
Yeah. I know a lot about these new cruise ships that come out all the time. You have some insider stories on this, right? They seem to really come out with new features every year. I've never been on a cruise, so I really don't know anything about cruises.
It's really a great way to travel. I think it's not only one of the best vacation values. People think they're very expensive, and there are expensive ones, but there's something for everybody in the cruise industry, just like in the rest of the vacation industry, you know, where there are budget hotels, there are mid-price hotels, and there are luxury hotels. The same kind of strata applies to the cruise industry. And they're just building these incredible ships with all these great features on them. So I was just on two of the industry's newest ships. One is the new Stottendam, and that is a Holland America Line ship. So Holland America is a great line that's been around a long time. And what they've done on this ship is they have partnerships with these prestigious musical enterprises. So, for instance, they made a deal with B.B. King's Blues Club to put blues musicians on board that are vetted through the Memphis B.B. Kings. Lincoln Center Stage is another venue in concert with Lincoln Center in New York for classical music. Billboard on Board is another venue on Board, and they partnered with Billboard to put music from the last 40 years on board the ship. So they've done great things, at least Holland America has, with their live entertainment in the evening. And on a lot of cruise lines, it's just kind of, oh, it's something to do to go listen to some music after dinner. But they really made it special on these Holland America Line ships, especially on these newer ones like the new Stottendam. And they've really ramped up the quality of the cuisine. Food is great. People used to think of cruises as just, you know, endless buffets, but that's not the case anymore. There are all these specialty restaurants on board the ships with great chefs and food that's comparable to the best restaurants in land-based resorts or in cities.
How is that pricing for food? I always have that impression that, the cruise tickets, from what the deals I've seen, they can be really, really affordable. But I always feel you're hostage to that cruise ship for a week, and it's very expensive to drink and eat for, you know, relatively mediocre quality. I don't know if we can say that, you know, for the industry as a whole, but or maybe it's different from company to company, but that's always been my fear that kept me back from taking a cruise.
Right. So it's a common misconception, actually, and the older lines, regardless of whether they're, you know, on the budget end or on the luxury end, I think do a very good job for their particular demographic in their market. So as far as value goes, a couple can cruise on some of the contemporary lines like Carnival, Norwegian, even Royal Caribbean, starting at about $150 a day. And that's per couple. And they get you get all your meals, your entertainment, your shipboard transportation, of course, great service. So, you know, for $150, you can't even touch a cheap hotel room in a city, right?
Yeah.
Without all those extras. And then it goes up from there. And like the line I was just talking about, Holland America, for instance, I've seen cruises on their ships that have gone with promotions as low as $150 or $200 a night per couple. And their restaurants are great. Their food is incredible. And it's gourmet quality. And almost
so
all of that is included.
Is their food included already? I actually don't know.
Yes.
That. So $150 is including three meals?
$150 includes three meals and snacks. So all the lines now have specialty restaurants that you can pay an extra charge to eat in. But you don't have to spend for the specialty restaurants. You can eat in the main dining room, the buffet area. So the food is included, and more than you could possibly want is all included in the fare. Alcohol is not, typically, so you pay extra for that. But the inclusive nature of a cruise, I think, really makes it a great value. And like I say, the quality of especially the cuisine has really improved in the last few years, and it's now restaurant quality cuisine in most cases.
I've got to hit you with another one of these cruise myths. You're probably going to tell me those are all bad statistics, but I hear a ton of news when people A, fall overboard, or B, there's a cruise ship in trouble, either because of major waves or just that they have issues with the engines. You could probably say the same thing about planes. Filled with cruises, maybe just because I don't have enough facts, those seem to be real, they're not.
Yeah, they aren't. And so we can knock down those myths one by one. Falling overboard, first of all, it doesn't happen by accident, I can tell you. That the railings are at least, people are drunk typically, and occasionally it happens when somebody's drunk, does something stupid late at night when they're drunk, like they may climb up on a wet railing and slip off. But nobody can just fall over on their own. The railings are all at least 4 feet high. When it does happen, mostly it's suicide, unfortunately. So people have committed suicide off the side of cruise ships, and that's most of what we hear about. So when we hear of somebody going overboard, it's typically suicide, very rarely somebody doing something stupid, but it does not happen by accident. You can't just fall overboard. And it's important for people who haven't cruised to understand that, because, you know, there's no way to know that otherwise.
Yeah.
And as far as ships getting in trouble, like the the Viking Sky incident that just happened off the coast of Norway, you know, where the ship lost engine power and in bad weather, and they started evacuating the ship. So that was a, you know, kind of a combination of factors. It was a one-off incident that was a combination of bad luck, bad weather, poor decisions, low engine oil, you know, all these things come together and cause something like that. But it was also kind of a one-off incident that is unlikely to reoccur, especially with the lessons that they learned, you know, from this incident.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that you know, just leads me to the next myth with the norovirus. I actually, when I travel, I met quite a few people that worked on cruise ships and that are now working in hotels or work in the airline industry. And many of them tell me the norovirus is a real problem. So it's something that is stuck on many ships, and it seems to be hard to get rid of once a couple of people are infected.
Yeah, so this is also, it doesn't happen as often as, you know, the media portrays it. So there's a, I was looking at the statistics for 2018. About 11 million people cruised from U.S. or North American ports, 11 million passengers.
That's a lot.
And that's a lot. And of those, there were only 547 reported cases of norovirus that were reported to the CDC. So by law, the cruise lines have to report norovirus cases that exceed a 3% threshold in the passenger load to the CDC. So once it's over 3% of passengers or crew that are sick, they have to report that. So there were only 547 individual cases, this is individual people, with reported norovirus out of 11 million who cruised. So I would take those odds pretty much any day. And I can tell you that the cruise lines do a great job at trying to lock it down when it does happen. I've been on ships when there was a norovirus outbreak, and you know, they pretty much cancel all any kind of self-service food or drink service. They quarantine sick people in their cabins. They're constantly wiping down surfaces with a bleach solution, an antiseptic solution. So they do a great job of really locking it down and confining it when it does happen. But when it happens, it's spectacular because everybody's together in one place, right? And yeah. So what we don't hear about are the majority of norovirus cases, which happen, you know, in schools, in institutional environments, in nursing homes. You know, those don't get reported, and everybody's living, like in the case of a school or cafeteria, people go home, right? They're dispersed, and they may have symptoms there, but they're not all together in one place, in one enclosed environment, like on a cruise ship. And thus, you know, it magnifies it when it happens on a cruise ship, and it becomes more spectacular news. But the risk of contracting norovirus on a cruise is only slightly more than falling overboard, I would say, which is pretty low.
Okay, that's good to hear. I mean, you know, it seems to be specific to the cruise industry. And as far as I know, it's being transmitted from person to person, like coughing and sneezing. And it never really happens in planes, at least it's not a story that I really follow. And, you know, planes, it's very uncomfortable to be so close to people for so long. And I, myself, mm-hmm. I got the flu a couple of times, some people who were sneezing behind me. But then, and there's food also involved, right?
And, but you know, it all goes back to people using good hygiene. So, yeah. What our mothers always told us, wash your hands with soap and water often, is the best
Still
way
valid.
To keep yourself healthy. Best way to keep yourself healthy, wherever you are.
Yeah. It's just a lot of airplane bathrooms are really, really gross in the first place.
They are gross. So you know what I do? I actually take, when I fly, I take some antiseptic wipes, like Lysol wipes, and a pack, and I just wipe down the tray table on the seat in front of me, of course, because that's the dirtiest part of the whole airplane. Wipe down the tray table, wipe down the seatbelt, wipe down the handrest, the armrests, and I'm just careful when I use the bathroom. You know, use a towel to open the door, to close the door. People just need to be aware of these things, and you can keep yourself healthy just by, you know, following basic common sense precautions.
Yeah, that certainly helps. I'm always a little worried about them, the air conditioning, because the air is reused and there's filters. But, you know, some of these jets are 10, 15 years old, and while they get a lot of maintenance for the, you know, mechanical parts, I always doubt the exchange of air filters. So it happened a couple of times to me, but certainly the wipes help. I feel it's one more thing to be worried about. And if you take a lot of flights, you eventually run out of these things. And, you know, you can't bring a lot of hand sanitizer either. So it's challenging. Right. I don't want to be too germaphobe. There's reports like on FlyOTalk where people go into hotel rooms and what they do for the first 2 hours basically disinfect every single surface. And then they change the sheets, you know, and bring their own sheets and towels. I'm like, if you're at that stage, right, you just shouldn't leave. I mean, that's just
right. Right, I agree.
I agree. Find the balance.
Right. You have to find a balance. You shouldn't leave. But yeah, what I do also when I get into my cruise cabin, I use the wipes. I just sanitize. I use the wipes just to wipe down the high touch areas that may not be cleaned during routine cleaning, like the telephone handle, the bathroom door handle, the TV remote, things like that that may be missed in cleaning. But just give them a quick wipe. Yeah, I do. And it takes 5 minutes, and then I feel a lot better about it. And you know, what I've read and found is that, you know, those areas harbor the most germs. So just take a normal precaution and spend a couple of minutes just cleaning up the environment. I don't go to the extreme of, you know, bringing my own sheets or spending too much time cleaning the room, but just a few quick swipes with a wipe, and I think that helps. And as far as the planes go, as far as the air on the planes, you're right. The older planes don't have as good air circulation or filters. But the newer equipment, certainly like the 787, has a great air exchange system. And the newer planes are much better. And I think for that reason, help keep us healthier.
Yeah, you can really feel that. I was just 2 weeks ago when I went to China, I was on the new A350, the, you know, latest variant of this, slightly longer, the 1000 that Cathay Pacific just got. And they're just so quiet, but they also, the air humidity is noticeably higher. And it's just, there's barely any noise from the AC. So a lot of innovation really went into the air conditioning system, which, you know, seems like an afterthought. But I think the Airbus especially got this right. The Boeing 77 has the same advantages because the air can be slightly more humid because of the composite fuselage.
Right. Introducing humidity was big because air has always been so dry on planes.
Yeah. Well, it seems like an afterthought, right? The quality of air in a plane, you want to make it safe, but this certainly will prevent a couple of diseases. I don't know. Have you ever gotten sick from cruise ships? Because I've gotten sick at least like half a dozen times from flying.
No, I've never been sick. You know, coming back from a cruise, and I have been sick after flights. You know, a couple of days after flights. So. I can certainly attest to that happening, probably as a result of being exposed to, you know, airborne viruses or bacteria on a plane. But no, I've never been sick on a cruise. And like I say, the one cruise I was on that had a norovirus outbreak, they were great about it. They really locked it down. They kept quarantined people who were sick in their cabins for, you know, 24 hours until their symptoms subsided. After their symptoms subsided, And they locked it down, and they ensured that it didn't become a large outbreak, and that's what they have to do, with, you know, in a current like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's good to hear. That's good statistics. I would panic slightly if I know there's a major norovirus outbreak on the ship. It's not, you can't really go anywhere, right? I mean, unless they land in the next port, which it seems like they did in your case. So you're a bit of a hostage there.
You are right. If the ship is infected, sometimes they won't even call at the next port, you know, if there's enough infection on board. But like I say, it rarely happens. So people shouldn't use that as a reason to avoid cruising because it happens very rarely.
Yeah. You also, I know you just went to Cuba, I think a couple of months ago. On the cruise?
A little while ago, but last year I was in Cuba, cruise.
Seems like a good way to do it. One of the things I noticed about Cuba is how, you know, it's very difficult to find chain hotels, find you know, hotels with good standards, at least from the outside, it might be different. And I'm curious about your opinion. It might be different once you get to the country. But in the major cities, that seemed to be a challenge. And also the way to pre-book them didn't seem to be so easy. And now it seems like just the last few days, I haven't fully read through it, but it seems like the Trump administration has made it harder to get to Cuba, get into the country. And it seems like you can't just go on a cruise anymore. Is that right?
No, you can't. Unfortunately, that clamped down. And now that's cruising to Cuba is now off the table. Effective immediately. So
okay.
This, the cruise lines essentially had, some of these itineraries were in progress and these ships had to miss that port of call, say in Havana, the 2 days in Havana and quick hurry up, line up another port of call. And for future cruises to Cuba these were scheduled, there were, you know, hundreds of sailings to Cuba that were scheduled over the next year. And those are all pulled back now, unfortunately. So it's very unfortunate, you know, for travelers, and devastating for the Cubans, because yeah. They were counting on this. You know, the cruise industry had ramped up because, after all, you know, Havana and Cuba was the forbidden fruit for so long for us Americans. And now we could go. And it was a fascinating place to visit. As you know, if you've been there, you know, it's kind of in a time warp. It looks like time stopped there about 60 years ago, and that's because it pretty much did. And it's different than anything else in the Caribbean, certainly, and just a fascinating place to visit culturally and historically. And I was recommending it to everyone to do it while they could, but now cruising is off the table. And also, the cruise ship was actually, I was saying that your cruise ship was your best hotel in Havana for the same reasons you mentioned. So the hotel infrastructure and, you know, the restaurant quality, all the tourism product really wasn't or isn't up to the standards that most Americans expect. And they've been catering to European and some South American tourists for years in beach resorts. But as far as the city hotels and the restaurants and the hotel infrastructure, you know, it just wasn't reliable in terms of power, water. Sometimes your toilet flushed, sometimes it didn't. And so most Americans don't want to you know, lower their standards like that when they travel. And so cruising was a great way to go. You're on your ship for a couple of days, and that's your hotel while you're right in the middle of Havana. And it was a great option.
Yeah, I think this was a great shortcut. I actually never been to Cuba for a long time. I have a German passport, so I could have gone. But it wasn't 100% clear because I also have an American passport and I'm an American citizen. That would be something that potentially someone would object to. So I never actually went. That was never really big on my list. And lately, when I really wanted to go, I felt like the internet is going to be unusable. Everyone who went there told me you have to go to a specific internet cafe and then you buy 30 minutes of internet. And that's kind of all you got. There's no LTE and there's no roaming. And even if you buy a local card, it's going to be slow. And I'm like, okay, this I can't do that. I have too much to do every day. Even if it's an hour or two, it's just not going to happen for me. So I really was hoping, you know, a cruise sounded like a great idea to me, with at least a certain internet infrastructure and a better hotel. So I always shied away from it. I know the Europeans love the beach resorts because they're incredibly cheap. I mean, for them, it's often the cheapest way to get to the Caribbean. And they really didn't mind the whole politics. And, you know, I don't mind the whole politics either. I find that a very difficult way to, you know, just stay away and not trade with the country, how this is going to pull them closer to America and away from Soviet Union. It never appeared to me that that strategy was particularly well designed. It's more like emotional.
I agree. Yeah, up to now, it's been a you know, the cheapest Caribbean vacation, especially for Europeans and Canadians.
Yeah.
And that's why it was popular. It was the cheapest way to spend a week on the beach in the Caribbean at these all-inclusive resorts with all your food and alcohol included. Exactly. And it was a great draw. And it still is. It still is for that market. But unfortunately for Americans now, it's tightened up, and it's really a shame. And like I say, it's a shame for Americans who should have gotten to experience Cuba, because it's right in our backyard and it's fascinating. But I think just devastating for the Cubans, because they were really depending on that revenue from all the cruise ship visits.
Yeah. Well, now we have to go to China to see communism in real life.
Right. That's right.
I was just there. You know, I always have mixed feelings about that. I grew up in Eastern Germany, so I know what it does to people's minds. It's often not visible. When you go to a country, you say, oh, wow, it's really good value. Like I was in Mozambique, a former communist country that seems very communist still, and it's a great value, and there's a lot of good news to this to the casual observer, but there's something going on that is very negative to people's minds. It hollows them out culturally. It's just to have this strong policy pushed on you, that really this orthodoxy that doesn't allow you to think left or right. And you know, every thought crime is being punished in a way that to outsiders, and especially Americans, we can't fathom this. We don't even know that this is a thing. You know, there's informants, because they all look the same to us.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So right. I was a mixed feeling going to a communist country.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a problem. And in China, it's very obvious, but only if you look behind the scenes. If you just go to China and look at the fantastic infrastructure they have, and there's a lot of things to admire. And they've really pulled off getting a middle class into, you know, like a middle income country. That's pretty spectacular in just a short time frame.
Right. They turned, there are a couple of hundred million middle class Chinese now all of a sudden in the last few years. So it's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, and they're really thankful for this, and they should be. But on the other hand, you know, this thought control is really beginning to take a toll, or even on people who were really hopeful that this, we make more money, we get more freedom in terms of thinking. It didn't really happen. Probably, if anything, it's gotten more tighter as more people got more rich. The thought control is stronger.
Do you find that the newly middle class Chinese people are pushing back on the thought control now that they realize how tight everything is? Or are they pushing back on that?
In private, maybe, but definitely not in public. And, in Eastern Germany, just the ratio of informants, of people who could basically just write a letter and you would be taken to a prison camp for at least a couple of years, there was no evidence needed. It was just, someone wrote a letter and that was the end of you. The ratio was about 60% were informants, and that includes old people and children. So basically every single adult or every second adult was definitely an informant. And you couldn't talk to them if you say the wrong word. They had people go to prison because they knew words in the wrong language. That was their crime, that they knew a word in Chinese or a word in Japanese, and that must have been a traitor. So it's really out of an Orwellian book. The society lived in that, and it was shielded from the outside. You know, China is the same. Everyone is shielded as you're not allowed to talk to foreigners, and you're not allowed to talk. You're not even allowed to use a VPN, so you can't really use the internet.
Yeah.
So people are not really pushing back because they're simply scared, and they know they're going to go to a labor camp if they say the wrong thing, if they speak too much English, if they don't have a good explanation for that. And they basically say, well, let's take the freedom we have, which there is a certain economic freedom, not for the small scale entrepreneurs, but there is money to be made if you work for Foxconn and to make a couple of $100 a month, which is a decent amount of money given how cheap local services are in China.
Sure.
So they take that freedom, and I don't blame them, but it's I feel it's sad, right? You could do so much better. But, they probably, it's a lot of brainwashing going on. A lot of people don't really see it that way. They don't have, they don't think back to the Roman Empire, or they don't think back really where China used to be. It's always been a little more authoritarian than other regions of the world. So, they'll probably suffer less from this than we think. But I don't know if this day will ever come in our lifetime that we're going to see a major change in China. The policy we had in just building more commerce and making people richer will lead to more freedom. That definitely didn't work. If anything, it probably went the other way. Surprisingly, because with the Soviet Union countries, it kind of worked that way.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting.
So I really want to talk to you about Las Vegas, especially, you know, we run a service that finds cheap hotel rates. That's what Mighty Travels Premium does. And we always find it hard to find good deals in Vegas unless it's like in the summer season. And the bigger trouble that we often face is that room rates go down in the 30s for some of the nice resorts, but then the resort fee is another $50 or $60. And
so actually,
you end up with $100.
Right. You have to figure on the resort fee, which is typically actually between 35 to 45 is the range for most resort fees. When I'm in Vegas, I write about Vegas a lot and I talk about it a lot, and I'm always looking for great hotel values. And so what I look at are, I inspect properties that have just been recently renovated. And so, you know, in Las Vegas, they renovate their rooms a little more often than in cities in other parts of the country or on other resort areas, just because of the sheer number of people coming in and out of the city. And it's a competitive thing. And so I look for whole towers that have just been renovated. And so recently I was at Bally's and Paris, which are right next to each other, you know, right across from Bellagio and Caesars. And Paris has a room category called Burgundy Rooms, which are all new, like completely new furnishings, draperies, linens, beds. It's like a new hotel room. And next door at Bally's, their resort tower was just refurbished. And those rooms are also brand new. And I've seen both of those. I look on their, you know, the rate calendar on their websites, starting, you know, midweek, Sunday through Thursday, which is the best time to go to Vegas, by the way. Sunday through Thursday, I've seen them as low as $100 a night, and that includes the resort fee. So that's kind of my marker when I look for great values, look for just recently refurbished rooms that are selling at what I consider to be a good value or a discount. And with Vegas, it's typically Sunday through Thursday, except for big convention periods, because on weekends, Southern Californians invade Vegas on weekends. And it's like the D-Day invasion, except in greater numbers. And so that drives up hotel rates, restaurants are unavailable, shows are full. So Sunday through Thursday, and right now, those are two of the properties, Bally's and Paris. Specifically those room types, the Burgundy rooms at Paris and the resort tower rooms at Bally's, that are, I think, a great value right now.
And can you lock in the specific tower when you make a booking? Because that's often an issue with a lot of hotels. You can only book, you know, a certain room designation with a king bed or a double queen, and then you end up in one of the towers, but they're very different. They're like 40 euros apart in terms of construction date. So is that possible on the website?
You can lock it in. A lot of times on the website, if you're booking directly on the websites, you'll see those particular room types on that tower. So what you don't want to accept is just a run-of-the-house room. They call it ROH or run-of-the-house. And that they'll just assign you anything. But yes, you can absolutely lock in certain towers, you know, especially at these properties. I've looked at those or certain room types. So that's what a good value is. And I think another great value right now is the Park MGM. Most people haven't even heard of it. So this was...
Is that an old hotel?
This was the Monte Carlo Resort, which is completely transformed by the owner, MGM Resorts, into what they call Park MGM. So this was a complete refresh done over the course of about 2 years. And Park MGM is this beautiful new hotel, great room product, more on the luxury side, and great values there too, because a lot of people haven't heard of it yet. So that's a good place to check. Also for Sunday through Thursday, I've seen rates just a little over 100 for those rooms, and that's more of on the luxury ladder, farther up the luxury ladder than Bally's or Paris. This is Park MGM, the luxury level is, I'd say, you know, on a par with maybe the Mirage, something like that. What I call mid-level luxury.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I was in Vegas just 2 years ago with my children, and obviously that's a very different kind of trip. You know, it's not a bunch of guys or bachelorette parties.
right.
So we had very different ideas about that trip, and we stayed at the SLS. That was brand new at the time. We got a wonderful deal, so I can really not complain, but the pool was adults only Saturday, Sunday. So that was a bummer. We didn't know about that. And there was no other pool. There was only one main pool.
Right.
There's a lot of smoke in the hotels, which I don't like in the first place. I find it really harmful for children. And the whole atmosphere at the SLS, and we walked through a couple of places up and down the strip. We felt the whole atmosphere is just not good for children. We had enough time to venture beyond that, and I think Vegas is a great family-friendly destination if you go to Red Rock. So outside into the national park, really beautiful views towards the city, and more like a desert park. And there's a lot of places that they're a little more suburban. They look a bit more like Phoenix. So we kind of escaped to there. We had a hard time making Vegas work for us as a real family destination. There's places like the pool at the Caesars. I think would have been a wonderful place. We walked by there. Do you have other tips? I always felt that if you go outside of this typical, girls or guys night out, it gets a little tricky to find what you want in Vegas.
It does. But yeah, for families especially. So you're right in looking off strip for families. So there's Red Rock Resort, there's Green Valley. These are off strip properties that you're right feel more like a resort than Scottsdale or Phoenix. I also like the M Resort, which is another off strip property, not as well known, only about 10 minutes from the strip, called the M Resort. I think it's very nice, also spread out like a Scottsdale resort. But as far as on the strip with families, so, there certainly are a lot of family appropriate activities. There are afternoon magic shows, dancing fountains, wildlife habitats. There are plenty of things that people can do with their kids. But why I don't call Vegas family friendly is because parents can't turn off the adult stimulation that's in their kids' faces all over, right? You saw that. Yeah. So, like these giant billboards cruising down the street advertising strip clubs, guys handing out flyers for escort services and giving you a card right on the street. So parents can't turn that off for their kids. And unless they're willing to answer some very uncomfortable questions like, what was that, Daddy? And unless parents are willing to answer those questions or just ignore them, it's not a family-friendly destination. And, Vegas was conceived for, it was designed for and built for adults. It's an adult playland, right? And people bring their kids, but at their own risk. So I certainly wouldn't call it family-friendly. It can be family-appropriate if a parent can make it that way, but it's hard to do if you're staying and playing on the strip to make it that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's interesting places, and it is very price competitive. That's something I like. There's a lot of big brands, but it's still, you find a lot of really price competitive places. There's lots of arcades for kids in some of the hotels. They have the major pool areas, which my kids love, and so I think the potential is there. It's just you need to look a little harder. I think also in terms of food, finding kid friendly food that's somewhat healthy, that is a bit of a challenge. You run into too many fast food chains. That can happen anywhere, but Vegas has a lot of big brands that came in over the last 20 years, very big international brands too. As well as in terms of cuisine also. But they're typically priced higher, and they're not a great, unless you really know where you need to go. I found it a little harder than I expected, but I didn't feel we went to Sin City. Or maybe that's just me, or I grew up in Europe. Maybe that's the way I look at things. That never bothered me too much. If you go down most European cities, if you have that angle, they're full of sin. I mean, they're strip clubs, every single block, and you're like, okay. Maybe they don't do as much advertising.
That's true. You're right. They don't do as much advertising, right?
Yeah. Maybe they are not allowed to. I don't actually know.
As far as hotel value goes, so I think it's the best in Las Vegas, actually. And so, it's common wisdom that U.S. hotel rooms are the best hotel value in the world. That's kind of thought that way, and I pretty much agree with that you can get more for your money in a U.S. hotel room than you can in terms of size and quality than other places in the world, other major, you know, tourism destinations.
But that's, Vegas, that's not true with the room rates anymore, because the room rates in the U.S. the last 3-4 years have been, you know, off the charts. That it's even like Singapore, Hong Kong is now cheaper than L.A. or San Francisco.
Well, so I'm talking about rooms in terms of quality. For I'm not talking about really high end. Say, let's just say for the value you get, say at a Residence Inn, you know, at a select service hotel like a Residence Inn, you can get that for, you know, $125 a night in some cities, and with a large room big enough for three people and a living room, you know, you can't touch that in Europe, right? You can't get anything like that in Europe that size for that price.
True.
Smaller and higher price. So, but I think Las Vegas does it even better. And some of these hotel rooms in Vegas, even on the luxury side, like I've seen rooms at Wynn, at Bellagio, under $200 a night, including the resort fee on some nights. And you can't touch a room of that caliber in any other city in the U.S. for under $300 or $400. So, you know, some of these rooms are equivalent to like a Four Seasons room or a Ritz-Carlton room. And so Vegas is a great value. You just have to know where to look and get in on the promotions. I advise people just to sign up on the hotel websites, and you'll get email promotions with better promos and options than you would see otherwise advertised. And there's some great values. You just have to dig a little bit.
Yeah. I stayed at the Palms. I think that's what it was called. That's a bit off strip, like a couple of blocks. Mm-hmm. That was fantastic value. It was in the middle of winter. And I think a couple of years ago, that was like $50, including the resort fee. Brand new room, a beautiful view. Obviously, you had to drive to the strip or take a taxi or walk or take an Uber. But that was certainly a great memory. But it took a while to get this place.
Yeah, and that's still a great value. So actually, they just redid that property. They spent the owner spent $700 million to completely redo that property in the last year. And it's beautiful now, and it's still a great value. It's still a great value. So, right, it's a little bit off strip. You need a car or take an Uber, but that's a good option if people don't want to pay prices, you know, strip prices. It's the Palms is a good option.
What do you think? I always wonder about this going to Vegas. In terms of revenue split, how much, and also profit split, how much subsidizes, the common saying is that the rooms basically just subsidize from the gambling, and that gambling is a much bigger business. The casinos bring in the money and the profits, and it's good enough to just break even in the room rate. Is that still true? But what are the size differences? So say there's $1 billion out of room rates, and then another $1 billion out of the casinos. Just making these numbers.
It's changed a lot, Torsten. So, you know, it used to be that gaming revenue drove everything else in Vegas. Now it's actually about 40% of the revenue pie is from gaming. So all of these other areas are expected to be their own revenue generators and make money. Okay. Hotel rooms, dining, shows, spas, shopping, all of these revenue centers are now expected to pull their own weight because they're not subsidized by gaming anymore. So they all do, you know, have a significant piece of the revenue pie for these casino resorts. So the calculus has certainly changed. Gaming is de-emphasized. It's still a large portion, of course. 40% is still, you know, a good chunk, but it's de-emphasized. You know, you don't have to come to Vegas and gamble. There's so much else to do. You know, the nightclubs, the pool parties, the restaurants, the great celebrity chefs there, the Cirque du Soleil shows and the other shows. So all of these other revenue centers are clicking and doing a great job, and thus gaming and the revenue from gaming is de-emphasized.
Is it still very profitable, or is it becoming more competitive, gambling?
Because
it still is?
Yeah, it still is very profitable. I mean, the house has a built-in advantage mathematically on every game in the casino.
Exactly.
So, It can't help be profitable, except occasionally when they get stinted by one of these whales, these high rollers that come in even from China and play a lot of baccarat, some heavy gambling and high stakes, and then that can put a dent in the casino revenue. But in general, for just standard everyday players like you and me, the mathematical advantage of the way every game is built is a sure thing for the house.
Yeah. Well, you can have a losing streak for a while, but I agree. So it's directly related to revenue. For a while in China, the big incentive to gamble, especially in places outside of China, was you could bring money. And even if you lose a certain percentage, whatever winnings you'd have, even if it's a loss, but you have some money that the casino pays out, that is money that you could export without any restrictions from China. And you probably remember that for a couple of years, that Macau started out of nowhere and then became the biggest gambling destination in the world within 2 or 3 years, surpassing Las Vegas. And the way it was, it's basically like going to a bank or sending a wire transfer. And that's why people went to Macau, because you could, didn't matter if you win or lose, as long as the bank or whoever runs the casino or hotel would give you a payout check at the end, that money was tax-free, and it was also exported without the restrictions from China. But there seems to be a big clampdown on this, so I don't think a lot of Chinese whales are showing up in the same numbers anymore.
That's true. And so in both in Macau and in Las Vegas, the Chinese clamped down on the big money leaving the country. So that was a big downer. That was a big downer for the casinos, of course. And so now, they're trying to cater more to the middle class, the newly mobile Chinese middle class who are traveling more and more. Yeah. And it's those customers that they're focusing on more now.
Yeah, that can really work. I can see that happening. They really love organized travel, and they are suggestible. As long as you give them, a concept around it, they're very suggestible travelers. While gambling isn't my favorite pastime, as you can probably tell, I can see that being a great market for the huge numbers of now mobile Chinese middle class. Before I let you go, I know you're restricted on time. I really wanted to learn about this big show business like Cirque du Soleil in Vegas. How did it came upon? And for me, it always seemed like this is a commodity show, and it's certainly entertaining. I actually went to two Cirque du Soleil shows, and I liked it. It wasn't my favorite, I'd say, but I definitely liked it. I always felt amazing how they pulled off such a big business out of nowhere. Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about the short history of that major entertainment show business that started in Vegas over the last 30, 40 years.
So it is an amazing what Cirque du Soleil has become in Las Vegas, especially, is pretty incredible. So I guess a little over 20 years ago, they started with their first show on the Strip, Mystère, which is at Treasure Island. They built a special theater just for this show. And that was successful. And that model, they built out that model to other properties on the Strip, mostly in MGM Resorts, almost all in MGM Resorts properties. Treasure Island used to belong to MGM Resorts. It's now independent. But all the other Cirque shows are in MGM Resorts properties on the Strip, because that was their business arrangement with MGM. And what people don't realize if they haven't seen a Cirque show in Las Vegas is you may have seen Cirque shows, touring shows around the country, where they set up the big tents. And those are great shows. But they can't match the sophistication or the scale of the shows that Cirque puts on in Las Vegas, specifically because they build these theaters just for the shows. So the Beatles' Love at the Mirage was built for that show. Ka at the MGM Grand was built for that show. And the shows are over the top spectacular. You can't see a show like this. I can pretty confidently say you can't see a show of this scale and sophistication anywhere else in the world, just because of the way Cirque has constructed the theaters and the casts and the shows. they're just great. There are these large spectaculars that can't be reproduced anywhere else, and they're great shows artistically. And so for that reason, they become this incredible success. You know, and people go to Vegas and they say, you know, which Cirque show did you see? Because
it's a thing. But I sometimes, you know, the ticket prices are pretty high, and it's not exactly like a football franchise where the branding is enormous and there's, you know, longstanding tradition and seeing the best in the sport. You know, with movies we have that it swings back and forth. From theaters to a private show, like on your TV or on devices, and then it goes back to movie theaters. But it remains, you know, a scalable digital product. I'm amazed at this live performance for a very specific, and it's a very, I agree with you, very unique event. But making it such an enormous must-do. I still don't know how they pulled it off. I understand it's a unique product and it is an appealing product, but that people go to like 5 of these shows every year, and you're like,
know,
hey, that's a little repetitive, and it's $100 per ticket.
Right. Yeah, it's an average of about $100 per ticket, and you're right. People try to see all of them, and they're all great. But I think one of the reasons why Cirque is so successful in Las Vegas, not only because they've got this spectacular, over the top product, just because of the sheer number of people coming in and out of the city. So 40 million people visited Las Vegas last year. And these shows run 2 shows a night in each of these showrooms. You know, sometimes they have one night when they're off. But with the revenue potential is enormous. And just because of the number of people coming into Las Vegas every year, they can kind of keep up, you know, with these shows. And you know, they're scaled up. Like everything else in Vegas is scaled up, bigger, more over the top. Same thing with the Cirque shows, and same thing with the other entertainment and the restaurants and the hotels. It's a resort destination like no other, just because of the number of people that come in and out, and for short visits, you know, typically 2 or 3 days, and the amount of money that's dropped in those short visits is pretty incredible. And so they find a way to take advantage of that, and they do a good job.
Yeah, I wonder if it can be duplicated somewhere else. You know, obviously Cirque du Soleil has done that already, but if someone else could break into that business and create something similar, maybe in Vegas, maybe in other cities. So this business always fascinated me, but you know, I haven't really looked into it any deeper. But that's one of the questions I always have, because it seems, you know, too expensive, too much live performance instead of something that you watch on a TV or watch on YouTube, compared to how other, you know, how the live performances have developed and how they've been monetized. So they definitely have something going for them. I just don't really figure out what it is.
They do. It's creativity. Yeah, frankly, yeah. I think it's creativity. Their shows are so creative and artistic and beautiful, and nobody else has been able to match that level of creativity and artistic ability with the acrobatics, with the shows, with the music. Nobody else has been able to put anything together on all those levels that click so well than Cirque. And until they do, until somebody else does, I think Cirque is going to be at the pinnacle of that type of spectacular.
Yeah, I'm amazed by it too. So I'm always looking, you know, that's one of the big observations I'm trying to make when going to different places, going to different countries. Not just what's, you know, like a hobby anthropologist, I'm looking at how country behaves differently, how different cultural norms shape people's thinking. Definitely being an entrepreneur, and I've done about 6 startups, and seeing other business opportunities and seeing how they scale up is extremely interesting. To see, to follow the path, sometimes you can, there's learnings in it, figuring out why seemingly similar businesses have succeeded and some didn't go anywhere. For instance, in some countries, that's a very, very easy to follow mechanism is Starbucks has been around for a long time and has been relatively aggressive from the beginning in international expansion. And in certain countries, everybody realized that coffee shops are a good business or decent business. Really, definitely depends on competition. And in some countries, Starbucks is basically has been rolling over the competition, bought a couple of them. It's just it's the predominant force, so nobody else is still around with the real with the real market share. And there's other countries where Starbucks has been around for 20 years, but is number 14 in terms of market size. And I find it fascinating if there's a way to predict that. If there's certain countries that you know tend towards adopting bigger brands quickly. Others who are not. It's definitely the industry.
It is.
Well, that was really great. Thanks for being on our podcast, David. Thanks for taking the time and thanks for being here. And I learned a ton about not just cruises and Vegas, but a lot of things that are behind this reality. So I really appreciate you coming on.
Sure, Torsten. I enjoyed talking to you, too. It was fun.
Thanks a lot. Hope to talk to you soon.
Hope to talk soon. Thanks.
If you like this podcast, why don't you check out David's websites, The Vegas Guru and Ocean Cruise Guru. Guru is the top-level domain name. It is no.com. Or check him out on Twitter, The Vegas Guru with an underscore, The Vegas Guru with an underscore, or The Cruise Guru with an underscore. That's David on social media. Check it out.